Beers of Alaska. Learn about them here.
IPAs, ales, and stouts, pilsners, porters too. Microbrew, homebrew, any craft you choose. Look before you leap, sip before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think.
Beers of Alaska.
Hello and welcome to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Seoul Dotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm your host, Bill Howell. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. Well, we are on live on the air here, as you guys can tell, because I'm already stumbling over my tongue. And we've got a great guest this month with Doug Hoag of Kenai River Brewing Company. Doug, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine.
Thanks, and thanks for being here. So first up, it's membership drive. So please call 907-513-1996 and make a donation or donate online at kdll.org. That's how we keep this radio station on the air. And if you want to hear more about beer, that's the way to make sure it happens. So also, because we're live, if you've got questions about anything, feel free to call that number and ask them. But to get started, the theme for this month's or this membership drive is local harvest.
Harvest. Yep, we're celebrating
local
harvest.
So one of the things we're going to be talking about today is using locally grown ingredients in brewing beer. So before we dive in, I got a couple of news notes that I wanted to mention. Anybody out there who might be listening to this online up in the Anchorage Valley way, tonight is the Mighty Monster Boo Fest at the State Fairgrounds in Palmer. Starts at 6 o'clock tonight, so if you want to check that out. And also, I saw a notice that the Denali Brew Club in Talkeetna closed yesterday for some upgrades, remodeling. So if you're up Talkeetna way, don't plan on going into the brew pub in downtown Talkeetna anytime soon. So that's news notes out of the way. So, Doug, let's talk about local ingredients. So,
yeah, so we actually use a locally sourced ingredient in every batch that we produce.
It's called water?
That's it. So we certainly use plenty of good Alaska water. And then really the locally grown and harvested product that we would use would be spruce tips for us. That's definitely our biggest ingredient.
So let's talk about spruce tips for a few minutes. It's particularly what type of spruce? It's like blue spruce, right?
Yeah, we just when the spruce tips are just coming out and they haven't formed yet, that's when we do we have them picked. The Kachemak Heritage Land Trust, they do pick those. This is actually a donation beer that we produce for them, and they their part is harvesting those spruce tips, so they do that in the spring. I think they're primarily gotten down in the Homer area, but they do pick some up here as well. So,
and then you would put them into the boil is that where you add them in the process?
We do. So we brew a double IPA is the it's a spruce tip double IPA that we manufacture, and we will put the spruce tips in a kind of like a nylon bag or a mesh bag, and then we dunk those in probably the last half an hour of the boil, and then we can pull those out completely, which makes it nice.
And my experience has been they kind of, most beers where people have used the spruce in, they give it a sort of a sweet, resiny kind of a taste. I mean, there's definitely some pine elements. There's some sweetness. How would you describe it?
Yeah, completely like that. It's the first time I tried making spruce tip beer, this is when I didn't have spruce tips to pick, but so I bought a like an extract, and I call that my pine sol beer because it seriously smelled and almost tasted like pine sol. So it was horrible first experience. Using real spruce tips is really quite amazing. When they are first dunked into the kettle, the aromas that come out of that kettle, and it fills the entire brew house, and it's really, really pleasant. Very Christmas tree-like, I guess you would say. So I noticed that in the beer, the finished beer as well, is the aroma is definitely has that little sweetie pine, and then just a really nice candy-like flavor.
Yeah. I would assume, too, you have to give some thought to exactly what hops you pair it with, because I would think you wouldn't want to go with something any of these new, very tropical, fruity hop varieties. That's going to really clash with the spruce tips. You want to lean more towards the traditional West Coast stuff that's sort of piney, resiny.
For sure. We'll use some Cascade and some hops like that. Part of the reason that we like it in a double IPA as well is because it has that malt background as well to really hold up to both of the flavor of a hop and the spruce tips.
Yeah, I think pretty much every brewery out there, or pretty much every brewery in the state, seems like at one time or another they've made a spruce tip beer. I guess it's everything's an homage to Captain Cook coming up here and brewing with spruce tips. So, but let's talk about some of the. Well, first off, let's remind everybody why we're doing this, which is we're looking for your donations or questions. Call 907-513-1996, or please donate online at kdll.org. So, other ingredients, local ingredients. I know a lot of people like to brew with honey. So have you ever done anything with honey? That's another thing that's fairly available up here.
Right. We have, but to be honest, it's not locally sourced, and it's primarily the expense. Our batches are so large that to do it on a commercial basis, it really would price the beer out of anything.
I hear what you're saying, because I use honey in some of the stuff that I make to sell, and prices seem to just keep climbing enormously. And honey, it's basically just it's basically just additional sugar, though it seems like it's slow for the yeast to consume.
It is different. We do use about a 5 gallon bucket of honey in our river water pale ale that we produce.
Okay.
So that is where we use that.
So what about birch syrup? Have you done anything with that? I know, again, that's another at least somewhat available local ingredient.
Yeah, we haven't used birch syrup. We toyed with birch water, but there really isn't. I mean, it's just easier to get. But man, to get any kind of flavor, you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell. We did use... This is going to sound weird, but we use some birch limbs or twigs, I guess you'd call them, in a we made a sati style beer.
Okay, yeah, so, finished style.
Yeah, so traditionally it would be like juniper boughs that you put in the mash tun. So we climbed up on a mound of snow and in the spring, and we cut down some limbs off of a tree and threw them in the mash tun.
And the result was?
It was a really good beer. It was our beer. We called it a yellow-bellied sapsucker, and it was delicious.
Okay.
Yep.
So you just you put them in with the mash done when you mashed in with the grain.
We did. Yeah.
Okay. And
we
did. Because the Finns use it as basically as their strainer.
A strainer.
To,
yep.
To get the when they're pulling the wort off the grain.
Correct. Yeah. We did use we ground up some juniper berries too, so we did have that.
All right. Well, there's been talk. I know there's a local fella. I've been trying to get him on the air here, who's thinking about opening local maltings.
Okay.
Which would, in theory, give you guys the ability to use locally produced or Alaska grown, let's say.
Right.
I don't think they're going to grow any barley here on the peninsula, but Alaska grown barley from up around Delta Junction. I know there's a few of the distilleries that do that around the state because obviously, I mean, have you heard anything about that? You got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some rumblings about it. I know they've been working a little bit up in the Delta Junction area to grow barley that would actually even work for brewing because, what they were producing is just really more...
like six row for animal feed.
Yeah, exactly. So to get the barley that would work good, like a good solid two row, and then of course having a malting facility to.
It's sort of always been a chicken and the egg issue. Nobody's going to grow the two row unless there's a maltings, and nobody's going to open a maltings unless there's somebody growing two row. So somehow you kind of get both of them off the ground at the same time.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And there's a few people that have high tunnels in the area and down in Homer that they grow hops. So not really enough for like a bigger commercial establishment, but you can certainly for a homebrew it's workable. When we were in our original facility, we used some from a Homer guy, and they actually it turned out really good. It was a really nice. It was more of a pale ale based. We're not completely set up to use fresh hops, so that was a bit of a challenge. We used our mash tun as a hop back after we had it kind of brewed, and then we'd push the beer into the mash tun.
Well, folks need to understand. I mean, you guys normally are using pelletized hops,
right,
which basically dissolve, as opposed to whole leaf hops, where when you get done, you have a whole bunch of soggy leaves. So you have to have some kind of way in your system that you're going to contain that and keep it from gumming up all the works. Yeah. So anyway, well, yeah, that's, I know we've had beers, various people have brewed like one-off batches in the past. That's the problem with hops is we're never going to be able to grow them on a commercial scale up here.
Right.
It's always going to be just a little bit here and there. But as you say, for a home brewer, sure, you could definitely grow enough to do some batches there.
Yep. So, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yep. Well, as our listeners out there, if you've got any questions for Doug or myself, remember, call us at 907-513-1996. You can also call that number to donate to KDLL or donate online at kdll.org.
We did have some questions that were sent in ahead of time. So whenever you're ready for those, let me know.
But hit us with one. So.
Okay. Doug already kind of touched on this, I think, and your discussion about locally grown hops. So Brian is experimenting with growing hops, and he's wondering about if you're going to add that for homebrew specifically. At what, when in the process is it best to add? Is it if you're going for wet hops, is it better to add later, or do you add sooner just to get that kind of flavor?
Yeah, really, they can be used exactly like you would use pellets. It's a different volume. It's going to look like a lot because you're still kind of going by weight a little bit. When you grow them yourself, unless you send them to a lab, you don't have a true idea of what the alpha acids or how the type of bitterness that you're going to get. So you can kind of feel the oil on the leaves or in the cone. It's not going to give you a true idea, but you can tell if they're at least kind of set. I know when we did it, it was more of a, we used pelletized in the boil, and then when we used it, it was almost like a dry hop, so we would put the fresh hops into the mash tun and then let the beer sit on that for a few minutes as we kind of circled it around. But you can, you, I mean, in the entire batch, I mean, you could certainly do it.
I would think again, I've never actually worked with any that I've grown myself or anything, but I would certainly lean toward using them later in the boil where you can get advantage of the flavor and the aroma, whether you do it at the very end or as a dry hop. You know, let's face it, bittering hops are, they're just primarily there for bittering, so I wouldn't waste my really cool homegrown hops on just throwing them in at the very beginning of the boil to bitter things up. Use some pellets and save your good stuff where it's going to make a difference.
And then I would definitely kind of put them in loosely in like a muslin bag or some kind of nylon bag that has good flow. You don't want to pack it too tight because then like the inside is still going to be dry when you're all done. But just for the ease of pulling that out and not having it end up in your fermentation.
Yeah, you haven't lived till you've clogged everything up with leaf hops and you're trying to clean it out. So one of the best investments I ever made as a home brewer was a hop spider. So you didn't even have to deal with it in the boil. You just hang that on the edge of the pot and throw the hops in, and then when you're done, you can just pull it out. And you get even with working with pelletized hops, so nice. It all comes out. You hardly have to strain anything after it's done. So, good question. Thanks a lot. So, let's talk of the brewery. What's up? What do you got planned here in the future?
Geez, well, right now we are. It's pretty much kind of recovery mode from the summer. So we're still brewing full time, trying to get caught up on stuff. It's scary for me to go in right now and look at the look at our tap menu on what we have, because currently we have no IPAs on tap. So that tells you the popularity of the IPAs. You know, we'd go in there at any one time and we'd have three or four. Right now, we do have the Riverwater Pale Ale, quite delicious. Probably my go-to beer right now that I've been drinking. But we will. This problem will be solved by Tuesday at the latest. So I have one of our brewers, Scott, is working today to hasten the absence of our IPAs.
Running it through the centrifuge?
Yeah, he's centrifuging today, and then Tony will polish everything up on Monday. And
why don't you tell everybody else about the centrifuge? Are you the only guys in the state? Well, forget about Alaskan because they're huge, but you're the only guys in the state that are running a centrifuge that you know of?
There's actually, and it's kind of nice because we've all purchased basically the same centrifuge, and that allows when you have major maintenance repair or just the normal maintenance on it. When you have to bring a tech up, then they hit all the breweries. So I know Denali has one, Midnight Sun has one, King Street. I might be missing somebody else, but and then we have another one.
So tell our listeners, what does the centrifuge do for you? Why have one?
Yeah, so the centrifuge for us, it allows us to probably within 10 days of beginning fermentation, we can start pulling this beer through the centrifuge, and what it does, it spins the beer and a lot, and kind of pulls out all the solids and helps to clarify it. And I guess, so there are two things that it does for us. First is getting a better clarity, which helps on shelf life, and it hastens the process so that we're not having to wait for gravity to pull everything out just naturally, to settle on the bottom of the fermenter. So we do that. We can also go a little bit deeper because you always have some residual hops and things that kind of settle down in the bottom. Well, we can start to dip into that, and even the yeast that it grows, we can start to pull that through the centrifuge. So we get a lot more extraction as well. So maybe an extra barrel and a half that we normally would have dumped because we couldn't use it. It would be too cloudy.
So basically, it saves you time in the process, which lets your whole brew house operate that much more efficiently. You can produce right on a shorter time scale. So, very nice.
Yeah. So, it's a really nice machine, very efficient. This one that we got, it has a built-in inline carbonation system as well. So that makes it really nice. So we use a little less CO2 than we normally would to carb up our beer. Because it's injecting it during the centrifuge piece, so it's spinning it into carbonation or into solution a lot easier.
Cool. So
yeah.
So what else have you got going on? I know you're waiting on the alcohol board for your new license. So.
Right. We have applied a number of months ago for a restaurant eating place license, which would allow us to run our tap room more like a regular restaurant. So slight hour changes that it would allow us to do. We'd also be able to start running a wine program, which we are ready to do as soon as we get the license, just to have a little bit of some different options for people who maybe don't like beer. So,
and it'd let you offer ciders and wines and things produced by other breweries.
Yep. And then, like this summer, we really got hammered in the tap room, and I have a lot of beer that I archive over the years, and we dug deep into those archive beers because I don't like to see empty taps, and so we had a lot of cool beer on tap this year during the summer, but we would be able to then serve more local beer if we are in a deficit from producing ourselves. We'd at least be able to bring some in from other breweries, which makes it fun because that's kind of the name of the game in craft brewery.
I like your tricksy way that you put the beers on too, as they go on and they're not on the menu. There's just a little step on the tap handle. If you're not paying attention, you like go by and say, "Oh, what's that?" And it's like a 5-gallon corny of some coffee stout from 5 years ago.
Yep,
or something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, it's kind of like what In-N-Out Burger. We're like the secret menu. Yep.
So you said we had another question there?
We do have a couple. All right. So again, in the realm of like home brewing with local ingredients. So several questions about fruit of various types. So berries, rhubarb, and whatnot. What works the best? How much do you need? And then one question specifically was about how to avoid contamination, like at what point in the process you would add the fruit.
Well, I have never brewed with fruit because fruit beers are not really my thing. So I'm going to turn that over to you, sir.
Yeah. So definitely in the homebrew realm, I would suggest you pick your fruit and freeze your fruit, because what that does is it allows the cells in the fruit to break down when they do thaw, and the juice comes out way easier. So you don't have to really squeeze or anything. You put it in a muslin bag. I think fruit is way better after fermentation is done. What you have to watch out for, if you bottle that though and you still have a lot of residual yeast, if you didn't let it set out, it could re-ferment. So you might want to put it in and allow it to maybe re-ferment a little bit in your fermenter before you bottle it or package it. As far as quantity, I think it's just a game you got to play, and just kind of, you know, you don't really know.
What about infection? How do you make sure your fruit's sterile?
Well,
sanitary.
I think one of the best secrets is the bottom shelf vodka, the cheapest vodka you can find, and then soak your fruit in it, and then strain that out, and then worst case, you have a nice flavored vodka that you can use for
cheap,
something else.
You have a cheap flavored vodka.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, I mean, we've actually used vodka to, like, we wanted to age a beer in oak, but we didn't really have like an oak barrel. Well, we had one, but we already used it before. So we cut it into pieces, and then we soaked those pieces in vodka, and then we put those in the fermenter. So got a nice little oak flavor, and we didn't have to worry about contamination. Or anything funky. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, hey, if you're listening and you've got any questions, call us at 907-513-1996. Or if you'd like to donate to the radio station, call that number or donate online at kdll.org. Yeah, to me, I know a lot of brewers out there, they like, at least commercial brewers, they like to use the sterile purees and things like that.
Aseptic fruit. Yeah.
Aseptic fruit, so they know that they don't have to worry about contamination. Though what you were talking about adding late, that's kind of like the traditional methodology for things like creeks and framboises that they make in Belgium, where they basically let the beer more or less ferment out, then add the fruit,
right,
and let it re-ferment when they're, I think, in the, put it in the bottle and stuff like that.
Yep.
So, but like you say, that's kind of risky, because if you re-ferments too much, you start blowing your bottles.
Yeah, yeah. You definitely want to put the fruit in during, like, let's say you rack it into a different vessel, and then maybe put your fruit in there. So most of the yeast is going to be moved off. There's still going to be a little bit, but then I'd say give it another couple weeks and just see what happens. And then you're probably safe to rack it again and then bottle it.
We got another question.
Oh, we got a couple more.
Woo-hoo.
All right. I may be going from more standard to more interesting. ambitious, we'll call it that. So more in the sort of herbaceous realm, a couple questions along those lines. So dandelions was one.
Okay.
Labrador tea.
Whoa.
So what would be the recommended treatment if you wanted to experiment with that? Or you could just say, no, don't experiment with that. That's probably also an option.
Yeah.
I've heard of dandelion wine.
I'm assuming that's where that came from.
Yeah, I've made dandelion wine before. It's certainly like a very delicate flavor. I don't know that in beer, man, I don't know if you'd really get anything out of it. It'd have to be a really light beer.
Low hops.
Yeah, low hops. Or a no hop. So
I could grow it.
Yeah, there's a guy down in Homer. What does he use? He uses a flower. It's every spring, and he makes this, but very very short shelf life because there's no hops in it at all. And it was tasty, but it's such a delicate flavor. I think it'd be tricky to use. Now you could probably try to put it like if you made a seltzer, but I don't know. I don't know how much flavor you get out of dandelion.
Then Labrador tea was the other one, which might be the same.
Yeah,
You can steep that, and maybe the vodka trick would work to get some of that flavor out.
Yeah, you probably could get a little bit. But again, that'd probably be almost like one of these, a gruit. Yeah.
Well, we all know that seltzers are the work of the devil, so we won't be talking about them today. So, that's something that I found is most beers tend to, I mean, if your average beer is going to be fairly robust, so whatever you're picking to use to flavor, it's got to have enough bottom, as the Brits would say, to stand up to that. Otherwise, it just ends up being overwhelmed.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
So, yeah, it's kind of like
kind of tricky. Yep.
Yeah, you just end up, you're just adding sugar or something like that, because whatever flavor you're trying to get just isn't there when the process gets done.
Right. It's almost like someone using gummy bears.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's like you throw gummy bears in that are basically gelatin and sugar, and they just dissolve, you know. But, hey, we all know it's marketing. Marketing is the secret to success. So when you get your new license and you can operate as a restaurant eating place, whenever that day comes, let's talk about beer dinner possibilities. I think that's something that a lot of our listeners might be interested in.
So there is a discussion going on amongst people at the brewery about a January beer dinner. So
as part of Alaska Beer Week?
To do it. Yeah. Okay. we've been putting it off for so long and we finally feel that we're ready. So regardless of a different license or not, we do plan on doing a beer dinner in January. So
that's what I say. The hell with dry January.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Who does that?
Dry January, sober October. Get rid of them all.
Yeah. There's only so many months. You can't start pulling them away.
Right. It's only so much time to drink. So.
Watch yourself, Bill.
Yeah.
I do have a couple more questions if you guys want to entertain another one.
Sure.
So this one did sound interesting, and I had not heard of this before. Dan came across a Chaga Stout from Denali Brewing Co. and is curious about how you would go about home brewing with chaga. He says he's got a bunch of it in birch trees in his yard. Never thought about that before, so.
And I have heard of it. I've tasted that beer before, but I...
Oh, we should probably explain what chaga is, too, if anyone's not familiar with it.
It's a mushroom, basically.
Yeah, it's a tree grows on birch trees. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Has some, like, health antioxidant type benefits,
which
supposedly.
We probably destroy by boiling it to make beer, but we won't go there. So,
yeah, as far as, like, when you'd put it in, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
maybe
a good question. I'd
almost guess
that.
It'd be some point in the boil. I don't know what else you'd get out of it, so... And the boil would be safer.
I would figure. You want to use it like last
almost like spruce tips. Yeah.
Yeah. Like sort of like spruce tips to put it in. And I mean, I think I've had it a couple of times too. And from what I remember, it just sort of gave it a kind of an earthy undertone to the stout, you know, kind of a, I don't know, you know, sort of like mushrooms have a sort of a meaty kind of flavor. I don't know, but that's what I would guess is, like you said, use it late in the boil,
right?
At, you know, like 10 minutes or something like that,
right? Yeah, on that stout realm is, and I guess this would be a locally sourced ingredients as well, but I know Grace Ridge down in Homer, they make a oyster stout, so there you go. And they do, I mean, it has that little underlying flavor.
For the saltiness. And, well, and you've made a coffee stout using locally roasted coffee.
Yep,
so again, that's kind of a local ingredient as well. So, not specifically Alaskan per se, but local.
And stouts are nice to have some of those, I guess, heavier flavored items in them. So, yeah.
Well, I guess another argument would be for a locally... ingredients would be aged in wooden barrels from a local distillery.
Yeah.
Right? If you had a barrel from Port Chilkoot or Alaska or one of the other distilleries that it had bourbon or something in it, and you aged your beer in that, that would be another local ingredient that you would use.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about barrel aging for a minute?
I don't have a ton of... personal experience with it, just because we don't have space, but we have done it before. We've brought in a few different barrels, primarily Winter Warlock was, and we did an Imperial Stout once, and that we barrel aged, but it's been a while.
Yeah, well, from a homebrewer's perspective, you can most obviously you're not going to fill a barrel, but you can get similar results with what you were talking about, like using oak cubes and soaking them instead of cheap ass vodka.
Right.
Soak them in a nice bourbon or something like that, and then add those into the secondary.
Yep.
So kind of get the same effects. At least for me, when it comes to barrel aging, I've always thought that maybe less is a little more. I want my beer to taste like beer with bourbon, not bourbon with beer. Yep. You know, it's so easy to overdo the whole bourbon barrel aging and end up with something that tastes more like bourbon than beer.
Yeah, real woody and oaky, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, bourbony.
So, yep.
Yeah, so what other questions do we have?
There's one more local ingredient question. So this is from a gardener specific, wondering about, brace yourself, Bill, other types of starches in beer. So, I mean, of course, you got your root vegetables, your potatoes, your sweet potatoes, your squashes, which would include pumpkin. So, and I know how Bill feels about pumpkin beer, but 'tis the season. So if one were to try and use what they grew in their garden, as far as like additional starches, how would they go about using that?
Well, my only complaint about pumpkin beer is really what you're talking about is pumpkin spice beer, because the pumpkin itself doesn't do a whole lot, but it's the spices. But
yeah, a little bit of sugar and a little bit.
You want to take this one? You ever brewed with anything,
I have
squash beer.
We did use canned pumpkin when we did it. A lot of canned pumpkin, and it was a jack-o'-lantern's nightmare brewing this batch. It was terrible. The beer turned out wonderful. I mean, it was delicious.
Is this one that you were brewing as part of a contest winner that I'm remembering, or something? Yeah, something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Yep. So, it was really good, and we had a blast doing it. like three or four stuck mashes and stuff like that. So yeah, it took a long, long time. That was probably the longest brew day I've ever had, maybe 11 hours. So yeah, it was a long day, but it was fun. But if you were to grow your pumpkins, I would suggest baking them like you're going to make a pie, and then use that puree. And again, muslin bags are wonderful for those thicker ingredients like that. You can put it in,
so the baking would help caramelize sugars and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah, soften it up, and so it's actually going to get into the beer a little bit. And it's going to be a lot of the sugar is really what you're going to be grabbing out of that. But
style wise, what would you go with?
Stout.
Stout. Yeah. Okay. So, but like I would go with for more on the lighter side stout, like not the heavy.
Yeah, not anything real big. I mean, and you can do imperial, but again, you're going to probably want
to. I mean, what was it? Midnight Sun used to do that one that was like an imperial porter.
Mm-hmm.
Their treat.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They did Trickster and they did Treat.
Yeah, they had Treat. Yeah, yep, yep.
And Trickster was the light one with the spices, and Treat was like an Imperial Porter or something.
I think so.
Yeah, I don't remember. So I noticed they're not brewing those too much anymore. I think the pumpkin beer craze has come and gone.
Yep,
the New England IPA craze follow it soon into the dustbin of history. So, any other questions, or have we hit them all?
Those are the local ingredient questions. I've got a couple other just beer-related questions, if you guys want to. Okay. So one of them is about cellaring. So they're wondering, is it the same treatment for any type of beer? Are there different strategies for different types of beers? What beers work better cellared? What's best to just drink immediately?
Right. Well, first thing I'll do is give a pitch for one of the... As far as I know, it's the only book solely on this subject, and one of the best books on it I've ever read by a guy named Patrick Dawson, Dawson. He wrote a book called Vintage Beer. You can pick it up for like about $13. It's a paperback, and it goes into just about any detail, things like that, about cellaring beer. So, in a nutshell, the rules for cellaring beer are, in my opinion, for whatever it's worth, and Doug can chime in here, it's got to be strong enough. So you're usually talking about something north of 7% alcohol, because alcohol is a preservative. There are exceptions to that, which are sours, which can tend to be cellared a little lower alcohol because of the bugs they have in them. It's not what you do with hoppy beers. Hops, your hoppy aroma and things like that, that's the most perishable thing about beer. So a really hoppy beer typically is not one you want to cellar. You want to cellar more your stouts, your barley wines, old ales, things like that. And most important thing is temperature stability. So you want to store them someplace where the temperature doesn't change a lot. Ideally down around between 50 and 55, but even if it's a little warmer, that's okay, as long as the temperature doesn't fluctuate wildly. It's the temperature changes that tend to cause the beer to deteriorate. And obviously you want to keep them out of light, because that does it. So that's kind of my rules for thumb. It's funny, I read an article recently, I think it was by Patrick Dawson, where he talked about how breweries have gotten away from making beers that are designed to be cellared. 10 years ago, it was really, really popular. All kinds of breweries were making stuff, and for various reasons, they've sort of moved away from it. Comments, what do you think about all that and cellaring? I mean, you cellar Winter Warlock for a year, basically. Yeah.
Winter Warlock is pretty much the only thing that we do hold. We have, like I said, in our one cooler, our walk-in cooler, if we brew a specialty batch of something, we'll usually keep, you know, 4 or 5 5-gallon kegs of it and just kind of tuck them away for future need. And sometimes we've done something silly like our Peninsula Brewers Reserve, and we flavor it with, let's say, tangerine. And for some reason, like, that got put, like a 5-gallon keg got put in the cellar. It's like, well, Now it's 2 years old, and we taste it, and it's like, well, we can get rid of that, because even kept cold, a light beer just doesn't hold up. It's a light beer is meant to be consumed in the first 3 months after brewing it, really. Yeah. So.
And that also raises an important point, is if you're going to start cellaring beer, you need to have a cellar book, whether it's an actual paper book or I use an Excel spreadsheet, but you need to keep a record of what you've got, when you put it in, and a target of when you want to drink it. Because if you just forget something and it sits there, odds are it's not going to be any good. You know, beer does not improve infinitely when it's cellared. It has a window, some things are a couple of years, more some things are 4 or 5, but it's the rare beer. I mean, there are a few out there, your Thomas Hardy's and a few others that can improve for 10 or 15 or 20 years, but most of them, like 5 years is the upper limit. And if you keep it longer than that, one exception is Alaskan smoked porter, because there's something about the smoke in it which helps preserve it. And I've had some of those that were 15, 20 years old that were still really, really good.
And I think even those, they hit that peak, and I think it's kind of, they've got some data on that. You probably want to drink that one.
That's one that Dawson talks about in his book. He actually has some data to show on that. So anyway, whatever you do, if you're going to cellar, make sure you keep track of how long stuff has been there so you don't. Because there's nothing more frustrating than spending a lot of money on a beer, saving it for 5 years, and then tasting it and realize you should have drunk it 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the money is just wasted. The money and time have just gone nowhere. So.
Yeah, I can speak to the keeping track of beer that you kind of cellar. So I had a teaching job at one point, and I homebrewed some beer. So it was the end of the school year. And I was going to be leaving for the summer, so I brewed an Imperial Stout, knowing that it'd be really nice to have it age. So I went to put it up in a little hiding spot, and I look, and I did the exact same thing the year before, and I forgot about it. So I had like already had a year old beer up there.
And how was it? Cool.
It was delicious. Yeah.
I've kind of find that with my homebrew is if I put a bottle aside and forget about it for like a year, it tastes a heck of a lot better than the stuff I drink after 3 months.
Yep. But
I'm so, what's the phrase, impatient. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to let a batch sit for that long. 49th State used to do that with their brewery up in Healy. They used to shut down for the winter Remember they did the hibernation series? Last thing they did was they'd fill all their tanks. And then they dial the heat in the brewery down to like 33 degrees and just let it sit all winter and then sell it the next year. So it's some interesting stuff. Well, speaking of interesting stuff, there's beer sitting on the table here, which we haven't tasted yet. So let's break this puppy out.
Okay.
We haven't yet figured out how to send this out over the radio. So you guys are just going to have to have it secondhand.
This is the portion of the show where Bill and Doug make everybody jealous.
Yes. Yeah.
So. I'll throw in the KDLL Studios would love to have you drop by. So if you're in the neighborhood, you could probably.
Do you have a?
Well, this is the faux mild, right, that you were telling me about?
Nope. This isn't. So what I brought today, because I know Bill has some thoughts on different beer. So this isn't. I was going to bring them our NA beer, but I didn't do that because I'm not that cruel. I'm not that cruel. This is our newest version of Winter Warlock. This is the new one. Yeah.
Is this the one that you've got on tap now?
It is.
Okay.
Yep.
So this has been a year.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I had some of this the other night when I was doing the lecture thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that is so good. And again, this beer really highlights the advantage you get, not necessarily by cellaring, but just by a long cold conditioning.
Where
the beer it gets so smooth and so clean tasting.
Yeah, it is a really fantastic. Nice. And the simplicity in the recipe is kind of what I like, because you don't have to get complex. You don't have to use a million different malts and hops and all this different staging.
This is a single malt.
This is
right?
a single malt. It's a floor malted Maris Otter is what we use. And then the hop that we use this year, we don't always use the same because I don't contract hops any longer. That was a little bit of a scam. But besides that, this is actually a German Magnum. So it was a nice, like a higher alpha acid German hop, but really nice. I think it turned out great. So
yeah, I love working with Maris Otter. I mean, to me, that malt, for those of you who don't know, Maris Otter is kind of a heirloom malt that was being used like 100 years ago. And some people have moved away from it because it's more expensive and there's cheaper malts out there. But by golly, when you taste something that's made with Maris Otter, you can taste it in the beer. And this is just fantastic.
Yeah, you can really tell a difference. And the extract's really good too, so you get a little more bang for the buck. So you are paying for the malt for sure, but
a difference.
Yep.
So, well, this is fantastic, Doug. Thanks for bringing it.
Well, good.
Well, if you got a question out there, you can call us at 907-513-1996, or if you want to donate, call that number or donate online at kdll.org. Well, if anybody out there wants to taste this, they can go by the brewery.
Yes.
Because it's on tap
it
right now.
It is on tap.
So, I think that's great that you do this. I think that's great when breweries have, I don't know what the rate I want is, traditions, mm-hmm. right, where we're going to do something at the same time every year. People know they can look forward to it, and, you know, whether it's a special release or
right.
something, you know, everybody knows the 1st of October, Kenai River, Winter Warlock's going to go on. So,
yeah, we've done that, yeah, for a number of years. I'm not sure how many it's been now. And,
you were doing it before you moved over to the new brewery, so that's more than, it's got to be like 10 years or something.
Yeah, at least, yeah. Yeah, we do have people that come in October 1st every year and just try the new batch.
Yeah, me, when I'm in town. When I was out of town this year, that's why I couldn't do it.
That's true.
So, but, yeah. Well, great. So what else you got? You got any, we know about the license. Have you got any other upgrades or anything that you've got planned for the brewery? Any, expansions, new equipment, any of that good stuff? Coming
no,
out
I think equipment wise, we're looking really good. We've added a lot of things, to really, I think kind of make our product even better. For us, it's really learning how to use those efficiently, which that's our focus for this whole year. Is we started September 1st, hitting things hard to see how we can maximize the entire facility. So we're hitting it pretty hard. So it's kind of a fun thing. We're making a lot of beer and kind of pushing it out there a little bit. So.
And sales are good, I take it? You guys are fully recovered from the big COVID crash?
Yeah, we feel pretty good. The summer was super busy. Staffing is great. We have probably, I think, the best people that could be working in our restaurant and brewery. It's we have great staff. And they are, it's such a stable staff that we're able to open 7 days a week now, and we're sustaining that. So we're, the last couple of years we've had to close on Mondays, and that's kind of something that we are happy to be able to have again.
Cool.
Yeah.
I do have one last question. We can maybe sneak in under the wires. Kind of more of a strategy question. It sounds like. Are there ways for consumers to advocate for different beers on tap at their local watering hole or to be carried at their local liquor store? If they won't regularly stock something you request, can you ask a store to order a small batch of something for you?
For the I can answer the liquor store question. I'll let Doug answer the brewery question. Absolutely. Okay. If there's something that you want, I would talk to the liquor store manager, liquor store owner. Ben Jakinski out at Country Liquors is very amenable to that sort of stuff. Now, that being said, there is a limit. what you want needs to be distributed in Alaska, okay? Because not all beers in the world are distributed to all states. And we could have another whole show about the three-tier system and limitations and stuff like that. But if the beer is available in Alaska, the liquor store should be able to get it for you. Now, they may want you to buy a case or something like that of it, but they should be able to get it. But that being said, not all beers make it to this state. You know, there's breweries go in and out of distribution in Alaska for a while. We had Dogfish Head was around, and then it went away for several years, and now it's back, for just as an example. So again, ask, and just occasionally, though, it may be beyond the control of the person at the liquor store. He can only get what's available in the state. So that being said, I'll turn it over to Doug for how you advocate for getting a beer on tap at a brewery.
Yeah, so
and I'm going to take notes because there's this mild that I've been wanting to see.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Well, we're not going to talk about brewing specifically, but no. So any beer, so if you come into our tap room, we will have 18 different taps of beer, and we don't distribute all of those. So there are certain beers that you can only get when you come to Kenai River Brewing Company. The beers that we do distribute, we have a list that's available at the brewery. There are some that we actually distribute in draft form, but not cans, and some are available in both ways. So one thing that you can do is like if you go into your local bar or liquor store, and you can ask if this is going to be available, and if they haven't heard of it, another thing is shooting us either an email or stopping in and talking to us and say, hey, at this specific place, I would like to have, this beer. And then we can let you first off know if that is something we distribute. And then secondly, then we can send salespeople over to that establishment and try to push it to get in there. So.
Hope that answered the question. Yeah. So is that it? Have we answered everything?
Those were the submitted questions.
Okay.
Way to go. Speed round.
Well, there you go. So we
did it.
Well, I think we're getting close to wrapping things up. So once again, I want to remind everybody that the number to call is 907-513-1996 to make a donation, or to donate, you can go online to kdll.org. I want to make sure that I thank Doug for coming in and taking an hour out of his Saturday to answer questions and ply me with some really, really good beer here. So I appreciate that.
Well, when we get offline here, I have a can of 2019 Winter Warlock. So we'll have to test that. So,
okay, that sounds even better. Nothing like a five-year-old.
Yep, so, exactly.
So that was it brewed in 2019 or did it?
It would have been 2018. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So it's 6 years old since it was brewed. Cool. Now you need to do the Wee Heavy Skelak Scottish again.
Yes, that would be fun to do.
That's a good beer.
Mm-hmm, that would be good.
Anyway, so final thoughts on local ingredients?
No, not really. I mean, if you're homebrewing, name of the game is experimentation. So just if you have something that you want to try, just try it.
Yeah. I mean, well, and there's, you know, somebody may well have done it before. There's this magic thing out there now called Google. Uh-huh. So if you, Google homebrewing with chaga mushrooms, something's probably going to come up where somebody has done it before, take all information with a grain of salt because it is the internet. Who knows what it's telling you? But I just remember the old days of the late 80s when I got into home brewing, and there wasn't this huge background of information that you could tap. You basically had your fellow local homebrewers and Zymergy magazine, and if one of them didn't have the information in it, you were going to do it trial and error. So, but anyway. get out there and homebrew, brew up stuff, support your local breweries. That's what this is all about. Support your local radio station. Keep the money here in Alaska. Keep us on the up and up. And we'll see you on the radio next week.
Yeah, I was going to say, if people have homebrew questions as well, you can always come into the brewery. We've got 5 brewers on staff, and they're more than happy to talk about beer. That's what they like to do. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Well, that will do it for Drinking on the Last Frontier special live edition. Thanks so much to Doug Hoag and Bill Howell for coming out here for our membership drive. If you enjoy local programming, having local experts on the air to answer your questions, we would sure love to hear from you. The number is 907-513-1996, or of course online, kdll.org. Or if you happen to be in the neighborhood, we are in the Economic Development District building in North Kenai. So before you make the curve headed out toward Nikiski, we're the last right after Baker Hughes. We've got the coffee on. We've got new mugs this membership drive. We'd love to send you home with one of those. And we'd love your questions for our next guests as well. When we come back here at noon, we're going to be talking about cooking with local ingredients. We've got a couple awesome local chefs here that are going to answer some questions and share their wisdom and tips and ideas for what to do with all that salmon or garden goodies or what have you. So stay tuned for that. This is, of course, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.